Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and I just returned from Los Angeles, so I'm glad to be back in the studio.
Welcome back, Tracy. Why were you there?
I was at PolicyLink's Equity Summit, which discusses racial inclusion in a variety of policy areas. I was there to talk about climate change, but I also had an opportunity to talk with elected officials and advocates, and also the president and CEO of PolicyLink. So we have those interviews later in the show.
So you brought us some fun presents back from LA.
Absolutely.
Well, we've also got a great panel lined up to talk about what Paul Ryan as speaker means for anti-poverty policy at the federal level. We'll be welcoming Eduardo Porter from the New York Times, as well as our friend Indy Dattagupta from the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality. But first, we've had some really important news this week, and so we had to bring in our senior criminal justice correspondent, Todd Cox. We just gave you a promotion. Did you hear it?
I did, and I'm so happy for that.
So, Todd, tell us what happened this week in the world of criminal justice.
Well, it's been a very exciting week. The president went to Newark, and he met with individuals who had an opportunity to turn their lives around and successfully reenter our communities after some period of incarceration. And I think it's an important moment in the criminal justice reform movement, because I think a lot of the focus has been on sentencing reform appropriately, and also a lot of the front end concerns regarding the legacy of the ailed war on drugs, and you know, the impact that had on sentencing and frankly putting people into prison. There hasn't really been a lot of focus on sort of the back end, as we call it, which is what happens when folks with criminal records confront barriers in society, what happens to their families, and sort of the ripple effect. And I think this is an important moment to shine a light on that. And so the president went to Newark and made some very important announcements. The most important one that we think were an announcement that OPM is going to take action to what we call ban the box for most competitive jobs on federal agencies. And of course, you know, banning the box is a movement that really got its start with the community, formerly incarcerated community of folks, returning citizens who felt that they were facing a barrier to employment, quite frankly, from having to disclose that they had a criminal record, and that resulted in them being excluded out of hand. The movement progressed from there to try to get states, companies, and the like to stop asking that question up front and delay the inquiry until sometime later in the process, hopefully close to the end of the process, after the person is found to be qualified, after that bias is removed. And then, you know, the employer can sort of ask the question, engage the person, and find out exactly what went on, and hopefully, you know, hire someone who is qualified for the job, obviously, but really is not, the employer isn't using the criminal record against the person out of hand. So it's a very important move for the president to do this for federal agencies. And he also made an announcement regarding what HUD is doing with regard to housing in this area, which is to, first of all, clarify its one strike and you're out rule, which had automatically excluded folks from federal housing, but then also making it clear that arrest records, or having an arrest record alone, does not automatically exclude you from federal housing. So these are two and very important announcements that the president made.
Well, really exciting news. Obviously, you mentioned OPM, the Office of Personnel Management. So his announcement was that they would be developing a rule. So that's something that we'll need to watch in the coming months that remain in this administration. Do you think that these were the right actions? Were these the right announcements from the administration in the last minute that we have with you?
Sure, I absolutely do. Number one, as I said before, it shines a light on an area of criminal justice reform that you know, is not getting the same level of attention, and yet I think it's sort of the front end, if you will, of the back end, and if folks aren't provided opportunities for employment, housing, and the like, we know that the likelihood of recidivation increases. So yes, these are very important announcements, and obviously it's limited to federal engagement, but we are hopeful that there'll be important models for states to take as well, and to make similar decisions.
Well, Todd, we really appreciate you taking the time to share this with us. We're expecting a lot more from this administration and from Congress in the weeks and months ahead, so we look forward to having you back. And thank you, as always, for reporting on criminal justice issues for Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you very much.
You're listening listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. With Paul Ryan tapped as Speaker of the House, many are wondering what this means for the party's trajectory. But we want to know what it means for conservative policies when it comes to poverty. The congressman received wide attention for his anti-poverty plan last year, which would consolidate a number of critical safety net programs into so-called opportunity grants, building on what he calls the success of temporary assistance for needy families, the meager block grant that replaced aid to families with dependent children. Most recently, he has announced that he will be convening a poverty summit early next year, featuring Republican presidential candidates and conservative thought leaders such as Arthur Brooks, to discuss the conservative approach to poverty and what we can expect with Speaker Ryan holding the gavel. We're joined by Eduardo Porter, economic scene columnist with The New York Times, and Indy Duttagupta, senior fellow at the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality. Thanks so much to you both for joining the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with you, Eduardo Porter, as you've devoted a lot of your reporting over the past few weeks to this subject. Most recently, you penned an article with the headline, "The Republican Party's Strategy to Ignore Poverty." Now, one might say that congressional Republicans such as Paul Ryan have been talking a lot about poverty lately. Why do you say that they're ignoring it?
Well, the basis for that headline is what happened to cash assistance for the poor in welfare reform, which was the conversion into temporary assistance for needy families, a block grant to the state rather than a federal entitlement to cash assistance. What happened in the intervening, 20 years was a gradual reduction in assistance to the poor and also a gradual, lack of attention, an increasing lack of attention, from the federal government to the needs of the populations who were really dependent on this sort of assistance. So kind of my conclusion there was that this block granting also allowed the federal government to sort of ignore the problem and just assume it had gone away by handing it over to the states, and by not adjusting the amounts of aid for inflation, in fact, allowing the aid to gradually wither.
Well, and I think it probably would be helpful to have a little bit of history and also to unpack some of those technical terms like block grant. So, Indy, I'm going to turn to you. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what happened in the 90s that led to the creation of temporary assistance for needy families, and what is a block grant?
In the 1990s, there was a lot of conversation over what we call essentially our welfare program. Back then, it was called AFDC, Aid for Families with Dependent Children. And there was some concern that it wasn't really serving the interests of the beneficiaries or the public at large. And it did need some redesign and work. And in fact, there were some exciting experiments going on at the state level through waivers that the Clinton administration had promoted. And we were seeing some phenomenal results, although some of those came out over a few years, where states really focused on work and also child well-being and gave families a package of services to help them gain a foothold and become more successful in the labor market. And not only did programs like the Minnesota Family Investment Program and New Hope Program, which was in Milwaukee, show incredible impacts improving sort of outcomes for the adults and for the kids, but they even had surprising positive impacts like promoting family formation. Unfortunately, the conversation became heavily politicized and fairly ideological, and instead of really building on what we were seeing was an effective approach, and including job guarantees, there was a strong reaction, especially among conservatives in Congress, that produced legislation that, in fact, President Clinton vetoed two times before finally signing a version of that legislation, the 1996 welfare law, which essentially ended the right that people had, people with very low incomes had, to access cash assistance in particular, but generally to access these benefits, and instead replacing it with this sort of flexible pot of funding that went to states and states could use for multiple varied purposes. That's essentially what a block grant is. And there's a real concern here that we have these effective programs like SNAP, formerly food stamps, stamps that are structured in a way that respond to economic downturns, get to people when they need them. And if people mistakenly evaluate the experience of the 1996 welfare law as more positive than it really was and use that as a model, that's a real risk that more people will be left behind by federal policy.
Well, and some of the criticisms that get raised when you start to bring up TANF and when you bring up block grants is that they can lose value over time and that they can thus shrink in terms of their effectiveness and how many families they're able to reach. Is that what we've seen with TANF, Indy?
With TANF, we've very much seen a decline in the inflation-adjusted value of the program. It was set at a fixed level in nominal dollar terms with no adjustments, really, even for a dramatically growing need during recessions. And that's a major concern with block grants. We really don't have a history of designing these grants in a way that shows responsiveness to national or local economic conditions. Yes, there are small things that we do here and there, but overall, if you look at what happened during the Great Recession from December 2007 through June 2009, the strongest safety net programs that really responded robustly to help people with the huge job losses and income drops were really the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, formerly food stamps, and others that are really structured in a way not to give states flexibility so much as to ensure that people who need them can get them. All that said, to be clear, there is a balance there, and programs like SNAP do give states some flexibility on things like asset tests and to some extent on who can access them. But the point is that fundamentally the federal government plays a unique role in our economy, and it should, as a result, also in our safety net, especially for economic downturns, but also more broadly equalizing funding when otherwise, if we leave it to states, you'll have poorer states being generally more stingy. And that's exactly what we see in practice.
And Eduardo Porter, you highlight Arizona in particular in one of your articles, and you actually mentioned that you were born in Arizona. You say that Arizona is a prime example of what's happened to TANF in states where Republicans are in control. What has happened to TANF in Arizona?
Well, Arizona pretty much shows how fast the program can shrink, actually. I mean, what happened most recently is that the assistance maximum assistance was shrunk to 12 months. The federal government allows a maximum of 5 years, but Arizona will only provide cash assistance for a maximum of 12 months. And this decision, which was taken earlier this year, will knock off another 5,000 families from the aid rolls by June of next year. So there immediately you can see kind of like how a state that is pinched for that is strapped for cash, that doesn't have an enormous commitment for, you know, cash assistance to the poor, will use it somehow as a piggy bank for other stuff continuously cut it down. This isn't the first time Arizona has trimmed it. It trimmed it first to 36 months, then to 24 months, now to 12 months. Then it also cuts the benefit. So actually it is gradually accessed kind of like the money available in TANF for other purposes, and then cut down its main purpose, which was providing cash assistance to the poor and helping them into jobs. And this is the other, you know, problem aside from not adjusting the block grants for inflation, was the fact that states had enormous flexibility in how to use the money, and in fact, through certain provisions, they were encouraged to cut the rolls as fast as they could. Because they had to, I mean, there were some certain work requirements. The beneficiaries had to be seeking work or in work after a certain number of years. But a way that states could get around these requirements was just by taking people off the rolls. And so a lot of states actually did that. And so by now, TANF only serves a very, very small percentage of very poor people. In fact, the stats that I was looking at was that only a quarter of families with children in poverty today get some form of welfare cash assistance. And even families for whom it would be available under law don't even access it anymore because the hoops that they have to jump through and the entire language of the program set up by certain states discourages them for applying.
And you highlight in one of your articles that just about 9 out of 100 poor families in Arizona actually benefit from TANF
yeah.
today.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't think that's the smallest share. There are some states in the South where, you know, where it's single digits as well.
Now, I'm going to erect a straw man here. Conservatives often like to talk about the success of TANF and of block grants more generally. Robert Doerr of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, or AEI, for example, recently authored an op-ed making many of the leading conservative claims that TANF boosted labor force participation among single mothers, that it cut poverty. I could go on. Now, Eduardo Porter, you've gone so far as to call block grants the central plank of the Republican approach to fighting poverty. Why do you make that argument?
I mean, well, Congressman Ryan's proposal, which was basically at its core had a block granting of a large chunk of the social safety net. From, you know, he's proposed a block granting Medicaid, Brockland, and pretty much every other element from TANF that we were talking about, to food stamps, to housing assistance, to energy aid to poor households. You know, the idea of putting that all together into what he calls an opportunity grant and handing it off to the states, it looks very much like what happened to welfare assistance in the mid-1990s. And now, I mean, just to address your straw man there, I think that there is a legitimate argument that work is the best anti-poverty tool, and that if you have instruments that encourage work amongst needy families, that will be a great strategy against poverty. But there's two problems with the approach that we've taken. One is that, in fact, TANF did not really encourage a lot of families out into work. The analysis since the welfare reform suggests that even though work did increase a lot amongst needy families afterwards, well, the booming economy of the second half of the 90s and other elements of policy change, in particular the expansion of wage subsidies through the earned income tax credit, are mostly responsible for the increase in labor force participation. And in fact, the TANF was really not used very much by the states to encourage work. I mean, in fact, a lot of states were doing was just cutting TANF to use the money to something else, not to encourage people into jobs. The reason Arizona did this latest cut to the cash assistance was because it needed the money for foster care. And so instead of, you know, raising state taxes or, you know, as one would think a government would do when it finds a new expenditure needs to be funded, it just found the money in TANF.
Now, Indy Duttagupta, I found it notable that Ron Haskins, a longtime former Republican staffer who's often hailed as one of the chief architects of TANF and of welfare reform more generally, he was quoted in one of Eduardo Porter's articles that we've been talking about as saying of TANF, quote, states didn't uphold their end of the bargain. So why do something like this again? And he's not alone. Peter Germanis, who was one of the White House aides who helped write President Reagan's famous welfare reform proposal, Up From Dependency, and he's been affiliated over the years with both AEI and Heritage, he published a confession of sorts earlier this year, apologizing, quote, to the extent that anything I ever wrote contributed to the creation of TANF or any block grant. And he went on to say, a block grant for a safety net program is bad public policy. Does this mean that we're starting to see a shift in conservatives' thinking, or are Haskins and Germanis kind of out on their own on this?
I think there are a lot of conservatives who are reconsidering the evidence about the 96 welfare law. There's others beyond Ron Haskins, who, as you mentioned, was the major architect of the law, and Peter Germanis, who contributed significantly to it as well. But that said, I think there's a lot more education that needs to happen. Look, fundamentally, the history of addressing poverty in the U.S. highlights a few, I think, important lessons. And one of them that I think is somewhat absent if you read the proposals from Speaker Ryan and others that continue to follow in the path of the 96 welfare law, precisely what Ron Haskins at Brookings is advising against, is that people, whatever disadvantages they face, when job opportunities and supports are made available to them, people want to work and they will take them. They don't need to be punished or threatened to work. If you make available enough decent job opportunities with the supports needed, like childcare and certainly subsidies like the earned income tax credit, because as we all know, there's jobs in America, especially at the bottom, routinely either don't pay enough or not stable enough or not flexible enough for anyone to raise a family on. But if you can provide these opportunities, which should be the first prong, really, in any serious poverty agenda that it claims to value work, then I think you'll find that a very large share of people who otherwise might need cash assistance will benefit. That said, we always need a cash safety net. And I think there is something to this insight by Peter Germanis, who used to be affiliated with the Heritage Foundation and American Enterprise Institute and other conservative think tanks, that it makes a lot less sense to structure a safety net program with a fixed amount of money, not responsive to need, not guaranteeing that the money gets to people in need and not for specified purposes. The only way that could make sense is if somehow you trust that intermediate entity, the states in this case. And if Ron Haskins says that it turns out we couldn't trust the states, I really don't know how anyone can disagree with it. Remember, he was President George W. Bush's welfare advisor. He was the lead House staffer, really congressional staffer, driving and designing the bill. And he's been a defender of the bill, frankly, and the law and the current program. But he is, I think, making a really important point. You know, I think the other thing I want to emphasize here is there's this idea that these programs, and I think Eduardo addresses this well in his articles, that these programs essentially discourage work and employment and public benefit programs. And I like to call these folks more moral hazard fundamentalists, because it's like it's like, of course there's some effect, but you know, we have safety belts and airbags in cars, and we don't say that's going to make people drive like they're crazy because their lives are going to be saved. People, by and large, want to work. People, by and large, want to earn money and support their families. And you get these very modest effects of programs like food stamps, which have very slight reduction in employment and earnings among beneficiaries. But what do you get in exchange for that? We have evidence that you get 40 years later, the kids who live in families that first were exposed to food stamps are healthier and do better as adults. These are amazingly powerful policy tools with very, very small trade-offs.
Well, I want to give each of you a last 30 seconds to wrap us up with what you think we can expect to see from Speaker Ryan when it comes to poverty. Indy, I'll start with you.
Well, I think that Speaker Ryan certainly has this toward the top of his agenda, and when he's there, there will be some discussion of poverty. Unfortunately, what I haven't seen so far, and I'm hopeful that his new role will give him a chance to listen to a lot more different viewpoints, but is an understanding of how effective programs are today. Yes, we can improve virtually every poverty reduction program, but it's also the case that we are starting in a much better place than I think he appreciates. And the fact is that our programs reduce poverty roughly in half, even if you account for any potential reductions in employment and earnings as a result of the programs. And the programs that are in place today have really dramatically pushed back on larger forces in the economy that we also need to take a hold of and really try to understand and tackle head on, that are exacerbating inequality and pushing it to extreme levels.
And Eduardo Porter, you'll get the last word. What can we expect from a Speaker Ryan when it comes to poverty?
Well, this is not about necessarily Speaker Ryan, but about the reality of the House of Representatives and the Republican Party. Frankly, I don't expect any type of any movement on poverty and policy reform to change our poverty strategy anytime soon. I think that the Republican Party has many, many other battles to go through before it gets to this. So I really, really don't expect any legislation. The odds of it are really long. And that is because, the party is of at least two minds on pretty much everything. And so I really can't see them unifying on a sort of poverty strategy, even though it might be important to the speaker.
Well, and we'll look forward to seeing what comes out of the Poverty Summit, which I'm sure we'll be covering in January on Talk Poverty Radio. Eduardo Porter with the New York Times and Indy Duttagupta with the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. This is Tracy Ross. So I'm in Los Angeles, where thousands of leaders, advocates, and stakeholders working on social justice issues are gathering for PolicyLink's 2015 Equity Summit. And I'm joined by Angela Glover-Blackwell, who's president and CEO of PolicyLink. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for being here.
So I'm really astounded by the number of people who are coming. You're offering over 60 sessions focused on various issues related to inclusion, justice, and prosperity. What are the primary goals of the summit?
The primary goals of this summit are to make sure that the equity movement is equipped with what it needs to take advantage of this moment. And this is a rare and sensational moment where all of the issues that we have been concerned about for decades are front and center. We need to expand our networks, and all the networks are here. The housing, the transportation, the health, all of the networks are here. We need to make sure that we're deepening our substantive knowledge. You can't have a moment like this where the world is ready to receive equity and not have deep knowledge about what that means, how we get there, how we measure it. This is also a time for us to understand that we have to build power. It's going to take power, politics, and policy, and the advocacy chops to advance all three to be able to take advantage of this. So people are learning what others are doing. They're seeing other campaigns. There are equity institutes where people can deepen their communication skills, their advocacy skills. This is the place to come to learn about the moment, to get the skills and the strengths and the knowledge to take advantage of the moment, and to build the collaborations and the networks that we need to win.
And so you mentioned that we're at a unique moment, and I think one of the things that makes this point in time where we are in 2015 particularly important about equity is the Black Lives Matter movement. And you have a panel of Black Lives activists who are going to be speaking later on in the summit. You know, there's a lot of critiques about the movement in terms of, you know, the youth that are leading it. There's a lot of comparisons to the civil rights movement. But one of the things that people don't talk about is that they're also advocating for Black communities to be invested in. You know, how do you think that the movement can contribute to better spotlighting Black communities and the needs of high poverty Black communities?
Black Lives Matter has been able to help the Black community feel seen. So often we have progressive movements in this country that impact what's happening in Black and Latino and Asian and Native American communities, but those communities often don't see themselves as being essential. Black Lives Matter puts Black people front and center. It makes it clear that if we don't get it right for Black people, we will be revisiting the problems of inequity and inequality again and again and again. It doesn't say that anybody else doesn't matter, but what it says, if we can get it right for those who have been most ostracized, most oppressed in society, we are then creating a system that's going to allow all to participate and prosper. Black Lives Matter, and when we really get that, we realize that it is the humanity in all of us that is going to be essential to go forward. The Black community has really appreciated that so much that has been an internal angst is now on the table, front and center, on the television. And the movement has been really smart about allowing people to come in whatever ways they are comfortable. But in terms of what it is pushing out, it's pushing out to the candidates running for president, it's pushing out to mayors, it's pushing out to police chiefs, that this isn't just going to be a moment in time. This is about fundamental transformation.
And I appreciated that you made it clear that this isn't about saying other people don't matter, because obviously a lot of people are choosing to misinterpret the Black Lives Matter movement as somehow being a black supremacy movement. I'm interested in how your take is in terms of, you know, putting racial equity at the center of policy when it's clear that so many people are uncomfortable talking about race. How can we do this in more productive ways?
People ought to be uncomfortable talking about race because it has been made into an ugly thing in America. We say race. What we mean is racism. And what could be more uncomfortable than talking about racism? Either you're perpetuating it, or you've been a recipient of it, or you have stood on the sidelines and you have said, that has nothing to do with me. It has to be uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable to talk about living in a society in which your life is not valued, in which you are not trusted, in which opportunity is cut off, or if you manage to get opportunity, it's fragile. It is uncomfortable being a racist in the 21st century, where it's clear that you have no place to go, that your day is over, that it is only a matter of time. It is uncomfortable knowing that people who may not feel that they hold racism in their hearts have allowed themselves to move smoothly through a society that is full of racism and they haven't called it out. So, yeah, it's an uncomfortable conversation. The good news is we're having it. And we're having it in a way that we have not had it before. We're having it in a sustained way. We're having it in a fundamental way that's talking about systemic and institutionalized. It's talking about the racism that's been baked in. It's one thing to say, oh, I freed myself from hating black people. But it's another to say, I live in a society that makes it hard for black people to move forward. And because we've allowed that racism to be baked in, it makes it hard for Latino people. It makes it hard for Asian people. It even makes it hard for white people who are not rich. Just think about it. If you're a white woman with a couple of children, low income, you move into a city like, say, Detroit or Chicago or St. Louis, and you have to go on a welfare system, you enter a system that was reformed on the image of a black woman with a bunch of children who didn't care about anything, because that negative image was put out there to allow us to take away supports from people who are poor. So this baked-in nature of racism hurts everybody, and we're having that conversation.
And so one of the things that we talk about a lot on Talk Poverty Radio is that poverty is the result of a broken economy. And Policy Link has put forward a model of rethinking that economy. And you guys talk about how equity is the superior growth model. Can you explain what that means? Especially, you know, you were just talking about how a poor white mother can be impacted by our broken social safety net, our broken economy. What does it look like to have equity be a superior growth model?
We say that equity is the superior growth model because the combination of the country's shifted demographics, already the majority of babies born are of color. By the end of this decade, the majority of children will be of color. By 2030, the majority of the young workforce will be of color. By 2043, the majority of the people in this nation will be of color. These are the groups that have been left behind. If we don't get it right for them, we don't get it right for the nation. When we think about the economy and the entrepreneurship that's needed, the leaders that are needed, the workers that are needed, the creativity that's needed, that if the economy cannot get that from the population, which is going to be a majority people of color population, the economy will not thrive. Equity, therefore, is the superior growth model. What's interesting about now is that people of color are embracing progressive economic policy and campaigns. And progressives are understanding that it's not really progressive if it can't pass the test of the equity, racial equity lens. And so we have a real coming together of understanding that the economy has needs going forward that can only be met by being able to tap the people who are going to be the future. Think about it. What's made this country extraordinary domestically and on the world stage is its vast and stable middle class. If people of color don't become the middle class, there'll be no middle class.
And you mentioned campaigns. So obviously we're in the midst of the 2016 election. You know, the primaries are already in full swing, even though the general election is more than a year away. And a lot of the debates have moved away from talking about poverty. Maybe they'll talk about middle class, but they don't really talk about poverty. They certainly don't talk about equity. You know, if you could ask the candidates in either the GOP debates or the Democratic debates, what question would you want in the candidates to respond to?
What are you going to do about poverty? Poverty is not a fringe issue. A third of the American people live in or near poverty. This is an American crisis. The middle class is made from people who move from poverty into the middle class. So I often interpret the middle class discussion as being a poverty discussion. People just need to call it out as being such, because we don't get a middle class if we're not allowing for economic mobility. Raj Chetty, who is here at our summit, has really focused the country on the fact that where you live is a proxy for economic mobility. And the things that really impact it are the educational system where you live, the transit system where you live, the health and the environmental concerns where you live, the power of labor where you live to be able to create conditions that allow families to actually achieve the kind of wages and working benefits that are important. And so I want the candidates to focus on poverty, but I want them to focus on it not as a charity issue. I want them to focus on it as fundamental to the future of the country. A third of Americans live in or near poverty. This is an American crisis. We got to get this fixed if we're going to really be able to talk about the things that we like to talk about is how's the middle class doing? The middle class is scared, in trouble, and slipping because we haven't dealt with poverty.
So you mentioned Raj Chetty, who's one of the, I guess, highlights of the summit for me, because I'm a big fan of his work and cite him a lot. What are you looking forward to personally over the next, you know, few days that we're here in Los Angeles?
I'm looking forward to all of the amazing speakers. We start off with Raj Chetty and Bill Spriggs, the chief economist for the AFL-CIO. Manuel Pastor is here. But so many people are here who are working on every aspect of the equity continuum. I'm looking forward to seeing the crowd respond to them. I'm looking forward to my own learning. I'm looking forward to people having some fun, because it's rare that we get to come together like this. We need to celebrate each other, enjoy each other, and refuel ourselves for the fight ahead. This is our moment. We must take advantage of it.
Angela Glover Blackwell, President and CEO of PolicyLink, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Tracy.
This is Tracy Ross. I'm still at the Equity Summit in Los Angeles, and I'm excited to be sitting down with Alderman Antonio French, who's in his second term as the alderman for the 21st Ward in St. Louis. Thank you so much for joining.
Oh, thank you.
So I was really excited to talk to you because you, I guess, came to national prominence through your coverage of the events in Ferguson. Also, I guess, as a role as brokering peace as the police turned violent against the protesters. So, you know, in the past year that there's been coverage of Ferguson, how do you feel like things have changed there?
So I get asked that question some often, you know, how have things changed? And, you know, my answer is that they haven't changed enough. We haven't made enough progress in the year or so since the events of August 2014. But we have had some steps in the right direction. We have had some legislation passed at the state level, which seeks to outlaw some practices that were really predatory on African-American, people of color, and especially poor people in those municipalities, including Ferguson and around Ferguson. The Department of Justice came in and shed a lot of light on the situation that existed in the city of Ferguson, which we know to also exist in many different municipalities around Ferguson as well. And so there have been some signs of hope, and I think the one that provides me the most hope is the amount of activism that we have seen since August, and including in August. And that's really what motivated me and kept me out there, was seeing so many people, especially young people, come out to take a stand. And I felt that my responsibility was there to one, try to keep them safe, and to support them in their calls for change. So there have been some signs for hope, but what we knew going into this thing is that it was going to take a very long time to dismantle some of these systems, to rebuild them in a way that was more equitable and fair.
And one of the things that, came to light after the DOJ report, and I should say came to light nationally because it was probably very well known in the area, where was the kind of offender-funded justice, that you have these fines and fees that were accounting for about 20% of the budget in, Ferguson. You spoke about this earlier today. Can you, briefly kind of explain what fines and fees are? What's problematic about this situation?
Sure. And so what the DOJ report highlighted was that a system exists in Ferguson, and what we know is that the system exists in many other municipalities. And in fact, Ferguson isn't even the worst perpetrator. But these systems exist that depend upon the revenue generated from over-citation, unjust ticketing, and court fees generated after the ticket is first initiated. And so as a result, you have so many people who have been victimized. Millions of dollars have been transferred out of really poor African-American pockets into government coffers. And it really became almost this kind of debtor's prison, where people were, if they could not pay, were thrown in jail, had to live in fear, driver's licenses are suspended, so they're constantly driving around in violation of the law, in fear of being arrested and thrown in jail at any time. And keep in mind, Ferguson is a very small municipality. In all these towns, we have about 90 municipalities in St. Louis County, many of them very tiny. And so, again, on a 10-minute or 15-minute drive, you will pass through 8 or 10 different municipalities. And so if you have a taillight out, that is 10 different police departments who can find you. That is 10 different warrants that may have been issued for your arrest for the same offense. And so it really became this system that weighed upon African Americans and their families. And let's not be confused, it still exists, is now known, but we are still now in the process of trying to dismantle it and make it more fair.
And so I read a recent report that said, because some of this is coming to light and there's more of an effort to shut down on it, that some municipalities, it's looking like they're going to have to get rid of their police forces. So can you, shed some light on, what's going on, and I guess what will happen if these police forces are shut down?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, one piece of legislation that passed the state legislature has limited the amount of revenue that a small municipality can generate through court fines and ticketing. Many of these municipalities, as I mentioned, are used to be all white. Many have become majority African-American. Some still have all-white governments, but many now even do have African-American governments. And these systems are still in place, though, even if it is an all-black government, that really prey upon African-Americans and poor people, and they have become reliant upon that revenue. And so now that the state has limited that revenue, these municipalities will either have to come up with another source of revenue or shift government resources to match the amount of revenue that they generate. And so that may lead to possible lowering of quality of life, lowering of government services provided in some of these small black towns. And so that is a concern. But what we have to do is figure out how to make sure that we don't make the lives of African-American families in the communities even worse, and shift our system of government to a way that is actually more equitable, more fair, and more sustainable. The system of citation, of taxation by citation, just is not sustainable. And so that is the next step that we'll have to see. It may lead to some governments dismantling. Mergers may occur. We've already seen a few police departments be dissolved, and people of those municipalities have contracted with St. Louis County Police. So this is going to take a while, and many of us have to stay focused, though, to make sure that we're not just addressing a knee-jerk reaction to what we saw in August of 2014, and actually are moving towards a system that is improving the quality of life for African Americans.
And that transitions great into my next question, in that in the closing plenary, they were talking about how Black Lives Matter is not just about criminal justice reform, even though it's discussed a lot in that context. And obviously, the movement was, or that, you know, the hashtag, which is also a movement, was started after the death of Trayvon Martin, but really, I think, took shape and really took off after the murder of Mike Brown. But one of the tenets, one of the demands on the platform is to reinvest in Black communities. So obviously it's Ferguson, the issues there, it's not just about the police, but it's about reimagining what that community looks like. What sorts of things are occurring on the ground to make sure that Ferguson is a more inclusive, more representative community of the residents there?
Yeah, so I mean, I was very glad to hear some of that talk, both in the in some of the panel discussions and on stage. It's very key. So to me, Black Lives Matter had always been about the quality of life of African Americans in this country. It is not just about police violence or police accountability. That is one aspect of improving Black lives, but there's so many others. And reinvesting in African American communities and, you know, communities of colors across the country is key. And so it's one thing to have change in the way of laws and policies, but then there's also the need to invest major funds into these areas to improve the quality of life. We have seen some of that in St. Louis County and in Ferguson following the attention of the events of August 2014. But really, if you drive through some of those areas that were most affected by the unrest, where Mike Brown lived and died, those areas look unchanged. And so we still have a lot of work to do in that. And so, you know, the amount of attention that was placed on this legislation that passed at the state level, I think, did not accurately put enough pressure on those same legislators to actually put their money where their mouth was. And so revenue has been cut. And I completely agree that, you know, the way they were generating that revenue was unjust and unsustainable. But that revenue has to be made up somehow. Otherwise, we're just going to have a decrease of quality of life issues. And that has not that conversation has not even started at the state level. So we still have a lot of work to do.
Now, before I let you go, one of the themes that has been resonating throughout this summit is that this is a unique time. And not only is it the height of so much more racial discussions in this country, but also we're in the midst of a presidential election. So we just had another GOP debate. There's going to be some more Democratic debates. If you could get one question into the debates from, you know, that all the candidates, regardless of party, would have to answer, what would it be?
Yeah, so that's a tough one. So there's actually two issues. So you asked me for one, but I might have two. The first is related to police accountability, and that is what can the next president do as head of the federal government to increase police accountability in America and therefore help to repair that broken relationship between communities of color and the police department. What we ought to understand is that it has a direct effect, obviously, on people of color living and dying and every day, but it also relates to crime rates across the country, is that police can't do their job if they don't have the trust of the community. In order to make them more than an occupying force and actual members of the community helping to keep our community safe, we have to be in partnership. And right now we find ourselves where this is this broken trust. And so if anybody cares about crime in America, you need to care about these issues. We have to fix this relationship. The other thing is about taking urban revitalization very seriously. And so, you know, these urban communities across America, cities like St. Louis and other places, really need the federal government to step up and see that investing in infrastructure, investing in job creation, lowering the African-American unemployment rate, which is still astronomically high, it has to be a national priority. We have to put our money where our mouths are. And so, you know, we talk about the amount of money we spend on defense spending, the amount of money we spend on other priorities. This has to be a priority for the next president. And so that's what I would ask him about.
Alderman Antonio French of the 21st Ward in St. Louis. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. This is Tracy Ross. I'm still in Los Angeles at the 2015 Equity Summit, and I'm here with Dixon Slingerland, who is the Executive Director of the Youth Policy Institute here in Los Angeles. Welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here, and I'm glad you're here in LA with us.
I know. I feel like I've been talking about having you on the show for a while now, because you've done two events with us since becoming a Promise Zone at the Center for American Progress. So it's great to be in Los Angeles. And you all did a mobile workshop for some of the people who are attending this summit, right?
Yeah, it was really exciting. We had a busload of folks come out to the Los Angeles Promise Zone to learn more about what we're doing, to see the community of Hollywood. This is the famous name Hollywood, but this is the real Hollywood, where you've got families living in poverty, very dense part of the city. So we brought them to our youth center. They got to hear directly from youth, a panel of youth. They got to hear some of the education efforts going on across the Promise Zone. So it was a really, really great visit.
And so one of the things I think that people are confused about what a Promise Zone is, they think that it often means that you guys got some sort of a big check, and then they get confused when they hear there's no money involved. So can you explain a little bit about what the Promise Zone designation is and what it has meant to your work?
Yeah, we had even confusion here in our local press. So when we were in the first round of Promise Zones, January 2014, a lot of excitement, and then the quick reality that there was no money that comes with it. We get five AmeriCorps Vista members, which is fantastic. They've been a wonderful resource. But the real benefit has been the competitive preference when we apply for federal funds. So in the last now two and a half years, we've been able to use the Promise Neighborhood and the Promise Zone to bring $137 million in new federal grants to Los Angeles for this place-based approach to fighting poverty. That's 35 different grants from 14 different federal agencies. I mean, before this, I'm not sure I knew there were 14 different federal agencies, all of whom are supporting this in different ways. And it has really shown the federal commitment and that breadth and depth of support to trying to make sure that what we're doing in, here in L.A. and in the other Promise Zones is going to work. So so we're fine now that there is no grant that came with it, because it's just been a fantastic opportunity.
So can you describe a little bit what your Promise Zone actually looks like, what the demographics are, and what you're trying to achieve?
Sure. So our Promise Zone has 165,000 residents. It's right in the heart of Los Angeles, stretching from Hollywood through Koreatown down into Pico Union. So not far from where we are here now in downtown. It's the densest part of LA and probably the most diverse. We've got Koreatown, Thai Town, Little Armenia, Filipino Town, a high concentration of Central American immigrants. So a really interesting community in that sense. Also an interesting community in that we've got high growth in the Hollywood part of the zone. So buildings, big, tall buildings are going up, and there's lots of job creation and startups coming in, connected by a metro line to families who are still living really in abject poverty, all within this very sort of tightly knit community, and nothing's very far apart from each other. So we're trying to show here in our zone, in any case, how can you link opportunity to the families that need it without displacing those families through gentrification. So it's an exciting experiment.
And you actually almost scooped my next question, is that one of the concerns that I have in doing, you know, place-based work and studying these issues is that as a community improves, there is the risk of displacing residents because of rising rents and that sort of thing. So what sorts of measures are you already putting in place to ensure that you aren't going to be displacing people as this community transforms?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different strategies around that, but some of them that we're focused on, obviously affordable housing is a key issue. So people being able to stay in the community, so people have expiring Section 8 or things, which the city's taking a very aggressive position on supporting that. But then also making sure that youth and adults have the skills to compete for these jobs that are right here in the zone that they live in. And so that's all about education. That's about the 45 schools in the Promise Zone and working with those youth. That's about job training centers and youth source centers for disconnected youth, youth who've dropped out of school, don't have employment, older youth. So we've really got to bring that skill set up if folks are going to take advantage of these opportunities. So if we can do that and we can use affordable housing strategies to keep people in place, then you've got the right ingredients for this to work. But it's certainly a challenge, and it's something that we worry about just like you do. But we think it's also an enormous opportunity.
And you mentioned the 45 different schools that are located within the Promise Zone. During the panel that you were just on, you mentioned that you're going to be transforming them into the community schools model. Can you discuss that a bit?
Yeah, so we're big believers in community schools. This is a notion that a school is open early, open late, open on the weekends. We take down those fences and walls and barriers that have schools sort of standing in isolation from their community. We're going to stop building community centers a block away from a school because the school can be the community center. So what we've done is place our own full-time staff on school sites. That's where they report to work every day. That's where they coordinate resources for students and families. That's where they work with parents and do workshops. That's where they work on wellness and health issues. And so we put our staff into schools, and then the school district puts their staff into our centers, family centers, youth centers, job training centers, because we believe anywhere a family goes in the zone should be a one-stop shop. It shouldn't be that we need to send them to all these different agencies. Wherever they go, we're going to make sure we've got all the pieces in place to support them.
And another unique thing about your Promise Zone that you work with, so the city was the lead, but your organization is the lead implementer. So when I say your zone, I'm thinking about the amount of work that you're doing implementing this, but you coordinated a grant application with the Philadelphia Promise Zone. What led to that partnership? Because it's really unique to see two different urban areas working together because they have, similar goals and tenets of their place-based initiative.
Yeah, that was really exciting. So that's an AmeriCorps grant where YPI, our nonprofit's the lead agency, and then we're placing 25 full-time members in our LA zone and then placing 25 in the Philadelphia Promise Zone in partnership with the city there. We just thought it would be cool to try to figure out how can two zones work together, in this case two urban zones, so that we can share best practices. In this case, we're working towards a common goal of college access, post-secondary access. So how can we use AmeriCorps members in our schools, in our centers, in these two different cities to achieve the same goal, the same outcome? And what can we learn from each other along the way? And how can we cross-train staff and cross-train members? And so I think it's going to be really exciting. I think it'll be interesting to see how it, I'm sure there will be challenges because it's always hard to do things in two places, particularly when they're so far apart. But it's one of the grants we've gotten through the Promise Zone that's been the most exciting to us.
So if there's a community out there that is not given, this designation, but really is interested in starting a place-based initiative where they're using, data to drive results, shared outcomes among different organizations, what piece of advice would you give to a community that's trying to get this sort of comprehensive planning off the ground?
Well, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's hard work getting folks to come together, particularly if you don't got a chunk of money to come together around. But it's absolutely vital to results-based work in any neighborhood, here in L.A. or across the country. And so it's about collaboration. It's about a willingness to share data. It's really hard to share data. People don't want to share data. But you've got to be willing to do it for the sake of the youth and families that we're working with. In our case in L.A., for the first time, we got the L.A. School District to share student-level data with us that goes into our data system, which probably took 2 years to negotiate that. So these things take time. It's about all being at the same table together and just continuing to work through it until you get to the best place for kids, which is what should drive all these conversations.
Now, before I let you go, one thing that we're interested in at the Center for American Progress is the idea of state-level promise zones. And we put out a report that's essentially describing how a state could implement their own initiative like this rather than waiting for the federal government because they have the tools and resources to do this. And you all are actually helping spur that in California. Could you describe a little bit about what's going on for the state here?
Yeah, I was going to be part of my answer to your previous question. If you want to be a promise zone and you're in California, support our ballot measure in 2016. So yeah, actually a little bit inspired by your guys' report, we began looking at what can we do here in California around this place-based approach. And so there will be a ballot measure on the state ballot November 2016, which would create 40 promise zones, so 40 state-level promise zones. Very similar to the federal model, which is that there'd be a little bit of money that folks get to develop their infrastructure and the data systems and things like that. But more is going to be about this competitive preference when those communities apply for state funding streams. Under the notion that what better place for a state agency to invest their resources than a community where all the actors at the table, they're all sharing data, they're all working towards common outcomes, they've got their stuff together. And so we think it's going to not only be great, obviously, for these 40 communities, but it's going to improve the efficiency and the outcomes of state resources that can invest it at the community level. So we think it's a win-win, and we're excited to see what the voters think a year from now.
Well, thank you so much for joining. We look forward to continuing to inform our listeners and partners about the ballot initiative. So, and congrats on the recent grant that you got. You're about to go celebrate, right?
Yeah, we're celebrating the P3 grant from the feds, which is the Performance Partnership Pilot, which was just announced today by the White House. Only nine locations in the country got it. So we're celebrating over in Boyle Heights with some federal officials. So it's great stuff.
Yeah, well, congrats, and thank you for letting me take you away from the celebration a bit to talk.
Yeah, no, happy to do it.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can listen on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the We Act Radio Network.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. Don't forget to rate us and leave us a review, and we'll be sure to shout out some of our loyal listeners on the air. You can also feel free to pitch us on some segment ideas via Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or by emailing us at info@talkpoverty.org.
We'll see you next week.